Good morning to you all. It's such a blessing to assemble in Jesus' name with you. It is a special blessing for me to have my entire family with me this morning. I don't think that's happened since the gospel meeting. So anytime when you're a family of eight and everybody is more or less able to leave the house, that's a really good day. So today's a really good day for us at the Combs house. Go ahead and turn in your Old Testaments to the book of Daniel. We're going to continue the march through this book that we began last week. So today is Daniel chapter 2. You remember the Apostle Peter in the scriptures that we read at the end of the sermon last week talked extensively in his first letter to the Christians that he was writing to in what is now Turkey, that they were supposed to think of themselves as elect Christian disciples of Jesus, but also in the sense of exiles, away from their homeland. Not necessarily their physical homeland. Maybe those Christians had always lived in those areas where they were living when Peter wrote to them, but they were living away from their true homeland of heaven. And when Peter talks to those Christians about that idea of exile, he's drawing from the entire swath of biblical history when he says that, because ever since Genesis 3, the people of God, humans created in God's image, have been living, in a sense, in exile away from him ever since our first forefathers and foremother bit into that fruit in the Garden of Eden. And you can see that thread running through so many different stories of so many different people that God has dealt with over the years. Like in Genesis, Joseph, for example. You know, Joseph may be, in a sense, the first true exile who is forced away from the place where he was living in to go live somewhere else where God is not at all worshipped, in Egypt. And he's got to figure that out. And he's got to maintain his hold and grasp on the ways and the thoughts of God. God remembered Joseph in that situation. He gave him support, even though it looked like, from the human perspective, he was alone. He's away from dad. He's away from his brothers. He's away from everybody who knows anything about Abraham and the promises God made to him. But God remembers Joseph. God also remembers Daniel and Daniel's friends. And so it is today that God remembers us. We are living in a modern day Babylon, but like them, we do not live alone. The God of heaven, as he is called repeatedly in this chapter, the God of heaven is with us. So as we begin this chapter, before we start reading it, what I'd like to do as we enter into this part of the book of Daniel is just give you a little bit of a larger picture of what's going on in this book. So if you look from chapters 2 all the way down through chapter 7, you'll notice a little bit of a structure here that the text kind of builds into a point and then builds out from that point in the same kind of way. So if you look at chapters 2 and chapter 7 at the beginning and the end, God is opening up the curtain about history, and he's revealing the future in some really interesting ways. In chapter 2, there is a dream. In chapter 7, there is a vision. And there are different kinds of pictures. One is a statue, and the other is this really scary vision of beasts, really ferocious animal-type things coming up into Daniel's line of sight. But in either of those visions and dreams, you have four massive empires in human history that are brought forward and put on the table. And in each of those situations, the person receiving the vision or the dream has no clue what it means until God says, okay, let me further reveal the interpretation of what I just gave you. And of course, the point in both of those chapters is God supreme. He reigns over the nations of the world. Then in chapters 3 and 6, you have similar things going on where there are God's people living in this foreign land, and they're encountering some really nasty conflict where they're holding on to their beliefs, and the people around them are pressuring them to kowtow to whatever everybody else is kowtowing to. And they face some consequences. In both situations, they get thrown into a scary thing. You know, in the case of Daniel's friends in chapter 3, they get thrown into a furnace. How would you like that? In chapter 6, Daniel doesn't get, you know, let off the hook. He has his own instance of persecution there, and he gets thrown into a lion's den. But in both instances, God protects his guys. And then in chapters 4 and 5, the middle of this structure, you have back-to-back chapters where a king of Babylon, is being given some sort of revelation from God because he's really arrogant. And so because he's elevating himself in this obscene kind of way, God has to bring him down. And in the case of Belshazzar, quite literally show him the writing on the wall. And so we'll look at these chapters as we get to them. But I want us to see where Daniel goes in these chapters so that we can see this broad overarching point that keeps being woven into all of these narratives. And that is that Yahweh, I am the God of the Jews, is not just some little god of a conquered people. He is the God of the heavens and the earth. He is the source of all wisdom and power, and he protects his people, even though his vessels might be sitting captured in a Babylonian temple somewhere, even though his people might be castrated and serving as eunuchs in a foreign court, even though all these things are happening to the Jews, God is still reigning as supreme. He's the one that knows what nobody else knows. He's the one that can do what no other God can do. He's demonstrating his authority. So that's where we're going in all of this. But now let's turn over to Daniel 2, and let's just simply walk through the text section by section. Let's talk about what it means here and then what it means for us. So read with me, beginning in chapter 2, verse 1. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. And the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, this is where that picks up here. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know with certainty, and you are trying to gain time because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. A thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. When you are the monarch of the most powerful empire in your neck of the woods, you have VIP access to pretty much anything that you want, right? And so when you have a dream that scares you in the middle of the night, what do you have access to? Well, you have a dream team that you can draw upon. You can get them to come in, and you have these professionals to tell you what the dream means. However, did you notice back there in chapter 1, verse 20, at the end of that chapter, when it says Daniel went through all of the training and all the literature and language of the Chaldeans, at the end of that training period, he is how many times better than everybody on the dream team? 10 times better. And yet, as chapter 2 picks up, Nebuchadnezzar calls in the regular old guys to give him the interpretation. I'm not sure what is going on there, but that's what he does. However, rather than do what Pharaoh does in Genesis 41, when he's got a dream, you remember he told his guys, here's my dream. There were these cows, there's some fat ones and the skinny ones, and here's some grain, and it was really weird. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't do that. He doesn't even tell what the dream was to his dream team. He just says, I want to know whether you have divine wisdom or not, and so I'm going to withhold that information. And so you tell me that, and then I'll know that your interpretation is actually true and not you just popping something off the top of your head to save your skin. The stakes are pretty high here. Either you're going to succeed and I'm going to just dump all these rewards on you, or if you fail, I mean, you're going to die in really gruesome ways and your house is going to be turned into an ash heap. Which one are you going to do, guys? And so the reaction of the sorcerers is pretty interesting here. There's this nervous back and forth. You just imagine being in their shoes. That would be a terrible place to be. They tell the king that what he is ordering them to do is just outside of their job description. I mean, king, this is not what you hired us to do. This is not what we can do. We can interpret dreams, but we need to have the dream first. And so they admit freely that they don't possess the wisdom to accomplish this task. I mean, notice what they say. No one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Isn't that a weird thing to say for an idolatrous Chaldean sorcerer? Because isn't the whole point of building a temple, in the way that they thought about this, the whole point of building a temple is so that your God can dwell with you? And there are so many different places that they could go in the city outside of the palace right here that would give them access to their idols. And so in a city full of idolatry, they tell the king that the gods can't be accessed. I don't know if anybody in that room was thinking about the irony of this situation, but as readers, I think that pretty well jumps out at us as we study this text. And they don't say, well, we're going to head over to Marduk's place, and we're going to pray to him, and we're going to offer some incense, and, you know, we'll fast overnight, and then in the morning, we'll come back to you with all the information that you want. There is no confidence in that. They don't even raise that possibility. They don't stall for time. They just flat out say, there's just no way we can do that. Because we don't serve gods that can help us out with that. So the king searches the limits of human wisdom, and he is disappointed. But Daniel's reaction is very different. His is full of belief and faith. Did you notice here that even before he knows what the dream is and what its interpretation is, he sets up an appointment with the king so that he can go in and tell him everything that he wants to know? Because Daniel is that confident in his God that I haven't prayed to my God yet, but I'm going to go to him and he's going to tell me everything about this, whatever business this is.
I just love that. Now, back there in 1:17, you remember how chapter 1 told us that Daniel already has extensive experience with dreams and visions and interpretations. But like Joseph before him, Daniel understands that the only reason why I get access to this kind of knowledge is because my God gives that blessing to me. And that is what he is confident in, not himself, but in the response of his God. As Jesus would teach later on in Matthew 7, in the scripture that Tyler just read for us, from the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus just emphatically says, ask, knock, seek, and it will be given to you. Because what does a father do with a son? Does he say, hey, here's a rock, here's a snake? No, here's bread, here's something good for you. I'm going to help you in your life. And that is exactly what Daniel is receiving here. I think as far as application goes, I think this whole section confronts us with this question. When you need answers in your life, when there is a big question mark hanging over your day or something about your day or your week or your month or your year, where do you go to seek answers for that? Do you primarily turn to the God of heaven, or do you turn to something or someone else? Do you trust primarily in the wisdom of human experts? And there are a lot of them out there, and many of them who aren't actually experts but are claiming to be that. You remember when Judah's King Asa contracted a really nasty foot disease? Do you remember how he handled that in Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 16? It says, even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but sought help from physicians. This point really hit me between the eyes just the other day, this last week. Jenny and I were having a conversation after the kids went to bed, and I was talking with her about a parenting issue that we're trying to get figured out. And my landing place with her during that conversation was this. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go to the shelf, and I'm going to get down all the parenting books, and I'm going to search through all those things, and that's how we're going to figure this out. And my landing place should have been, okay, now that we've laid out the problem here, the very first thing that we've got to do about this is we have to go to God. We need to pray to him to give us the wisdom that we so desperately lack and so desperately need in our home with our children. But that wasn't what I said, that wasn't what I thought. So this can hit us in a lot of different ways. Now, I want to just clarify, obviously, there's nothing wrong with books. There's nothing wrong with physicians. There's nothing wrong with human experts and consulting them and trying to research a problem and figure it out using the available tools that we have. But here's the point. If our initial gut reaction is, let me call in all the human experts and professionals to give me counsel, then our gut is wrong, and we need to change our gut. There is simply no substitute for primarily, first and foremost, directly seeking the Lord himself. Remember what James 1 says? If any one of you lacks wisdom, let him ask Google. Let him ask his best friends. Let him ask the preacher. Let him ask the elders. Let him ask somebody in the church. Let him ask God, who gives to all generously without reproach, and it will be given to him, as it has been done throughout time. So Daniel understood this. I think we need to understand that too. There's nothing in what I just said that is really profound or something that you didn't already know. But if you're like me, you need to do a better job of applying what you know. So there's that. Let's keep reading in verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him," which nicely hooks into our yearly theme. Verse 23, "To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." Therefore, Daniel went in to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus to him, "I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation." The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream that I've seen, its interpretation?" Daniel answered the king and said, "No wise man, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed came thoughts of what would be after this, and he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind." When Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, you need to ask, and you need to seek, and you need to knock, the people who heard him speak those words for the first time probably, hopefully, would have thought about occasions like this in the scriptures that they already knew about, where people did this, where Daniel and his friends get together and they pray. And what's interesting is they didn't have a temple right in front of them. Unlike the Babylonians, who could go to Marduk's temple, go to all these other idolater places. And yet, despite the fact that they are hundreds of miles away from Jerusalem and the Temple Mount, their God is accessible by prayer. So they ask, and he answers with this revelation, just as Daniel expected. And then the prayer that Daniel offers, beginning in verse 20, is so beautiful to me. You know, it's interesting that throughout this book, people address human kings by saying, "O king, live forever. O king, live forever." And of course, none of these kings do actually live forever. But did you notice in verse 20, Daniel addresses God by saying, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever." That is actually something that can and does happen and happens to this day. In verse 9, you remember in Nebuchadnezzar's really angry speech that he makes to his court astrologers, he says to them, "You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words till the times change." But then in this prayer, did you notice in verse 21, Daniel recognizes God as the one who changes times and seasons. He has control over that. And so he gives thanks and praise to this God who gives him light, because he dwells in light and he cares about the servants who are wandering around in a dark place like the place of Babylon. And so then he approaches the king. And man, you can see the contrast between Arioch and Daniel here. Arioch is this social climber. He's this guy who's got a high position already, but he wants even more favor from the king. And so he says, "Yeah, I found this guy, and he can help you, O king." And so he's trying to receive glory himself. And then Daniel comes in, and Daniel's got a shot at receiving glory because Nebuchadnezzar looks at him and says, "Can you do this?" And Daniel says, "Well, look, verse 30, I'm just the messenger boy. There's nothing in me that is spectacular or amazing more than anybody else. I'm just the one that God picked to give you the message. And here it is, but it's not me. That's the contrast between the people of the world and the people of God. The people of God understand that we are not to have the spotlight centered on us, that belongs to God and God only, and we just beat ourselves up against the wall if that's what we try to do as our aim and our ambition. Arioch didn't get that because he doesn't serve God yet. But notice how Daniel, when he comes in and he gets this question, are you able to do this? He agrees with what the Chaldeans already said in verses 10 and 11, that this understanding is beyond the capabilities of mortals. But, and it's a good thing he said what he said afterwards, or Nebuchadnezzar would have been, okay, get rid of this guy. There is a God in heaven who can reveal mysteries. And so Daniel is given the opportunity to do this for Nebuchadnezzar. Do we show Daniel's kind of God-oriented gratitude when we are given answers to a question that we sincerely wanted to know the answer to? When we find some kind of measure of success in our lives, when we are able to then broaden ourselves out to other people, and then we start being able to help other people find answers that they're looking for too, like Daniel's doing here. Are we constantly recentering our minds on God when success is finding us? Ideally, we should all be growing a lot more and more in our knowledge of Scripture and our ability to teach it to fellow Christians, to people in the world, and serve others. But there are real dangers that come with growth, are there not? I mean, the less incompetent you feel and the stronger that you get, the more Satan is going to whisper in your ear, your success is because you are a cut above the rest. And what you were able to do here, it was because of your wisdom that you understand more than other people do around you. And of course, lies like that are absolute baloney. Before this chapter is over, Daniel is going to get an opportunity to receive unimaginable glory, some of the best honors that Babylon had to offer. But the way that he stays humble throughout all that is he says what he does in verse 30, like we said earlier. And I think this is something for us as Christians to always keep in the back of our minds, that the stronger we grow in Christ, the more potential there is for spiritual weakness to set in and seep into our souls through the cracks of pride, if that is in us. You remember even the Apostle Paul, as mature as he was, remember he says in 2 Corinthians, I got a thorn in the flesh. Why did he get that thorn? Do you remember? Because he was given surpassing revelations from God that the other people around him weren't getting. And so to keep me humble, he says, I got this thorn. And remember, he prayed three times to Jesus, can you get this out of me? This is painful. And Jesus told him, no, you need that. Because you have my grace, and that's sufficient for you, but my power is made perfect in weakness. You have to be reminded that you're weak, Paul, and that I'm strong. May God always give us thorns when we need them. That's a difficult thing to pray for, because you're going to get it then. But we're going to be better off for it, and we're going to be more useful for the Lord's work when we do. So may we have Daniel's thoughts in our mind, and may we remember Paul's question to the Corinthians in the first letter in chapter 4, where he says, what do you have that you did not receive? What do you have that you weren't given by the hand of God? Let's keep reading. Verse 31. in the text. You saw, O king, here's the dream. And behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. And as you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and shall bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. Some dreams are really nice to experience, but this one is kind of like a nightmare. You know how he says at the beginning of this section, the statue was frightening in appearance. So it's scary, and then something happens to the statue that's also rather scary as well. So you have the statue made up of all these different metals that humans could use and value, and then this stone just appears out of nowhere in a supernatural kind of way. Notice it's not cut out by human hands. It is divine, and this stone strikes and destroys the statue, and then the stone doesn't go away, but the statue, all the pieces of it do, but that stone grows. It becomes this impenetrable, massive mountain that nobody can ignore and nobody can move or dislodge. It's just there, being its mountain self, and it fills up the entire world, even though all these other things pass away. At this point, as he gets into the interpretation, I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar is just sitting on the edge of the seat. And the first thing he's told probably sounds pretty good to him, that this top part of the statue, the gold part, the head of the statue, that's actually you, Nebuchadnezzar. That's your kingdom of Babylon, and it's big and it's beautiful, and you have been given. Kind of interesting, we think about the title King of Kings as often referring to Jesus Christ. It's interesting that God chooses to say to Nebuchadnezzar with this phrase, you have been given pretty much everything in terms of authority and power that you want. All these people and even animals are put under your thumb. But the day is coming when your kingdom is going to be turned over to another kingdom. It's not even going to be as good of a kingdom as yours was. It's going to be inferior to Babylon. And then there's going to be a next one. And then there's going to be a next one. And that one's going to be really strong and ferocious, but that one's going to pass along the way as well. But during the days of those kings, God is going to set up his kingdom. And there is no possible way for that kingdom to fail or to pass away. It's going to last. And from this side of the cross, we understand that that's the kingdom of Jesus's people. Do we appreciate living in this everlasting kingdom that we're all a part of in Jesus Christ? Sometimes I see Christians posting a constant stream of criticisms about a political party or a particular politician online, whether it's Facebook or whatever. And I have to wonder, when I see all of those posts, which kingdom is that Christian thinking about more often in their lives? Once I've even heard a Christian vaguely bring up the possibility of physical violence against a political party that he was extremely frustrated with. And this is why it matters. Whether or not we are wrapped up in our minds and our hearts in the kingdom of this world as opposed to the kingdom of our God, because it changes the direction of your struggle. You know, we are all geared up for a struggle, but the only question is, where and how should you be doing that struggling? And remember what Paul says in Ephesians 6? Our struggle is not against what? Flesh and blood, but against the rulers and the authorities of the heavenly places that are wicked and corrupt and trying to bring us down. The armor of God that he has made for us does nothing to protect our physical bodies. I mean, when you enter the Roman army, they're going to outfit you with a bunch of metal that you strap onto yourself. When you enter the army of God and you are baptized into the water to be raised in newness of life, we're not going to issue you some Kevlar, all right? We're not going to give you anything for your physical body. That's not what the armor of God is, because that's not what the fight is all about. It's about the spiritual warfare that we're all desperately struggling in. Jesus told his people not to fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather to fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Matthew 10:13. So we don't lose sleep over politics. We shouldn't. Because we have much, much bigger fish to fry than that. And that's why when Jesus came here and they were all thinking he's going to kick out the Romans, at every turn he said things like, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would be fighting. And when his servant took out a sword in the Garden of Gethsemane and hacked off somebody's ear, and as it's lying on the ground, he picks up the ear, he puts it back onto the servant of the high priest, and he tells Peter, you put that sword away, because that is not who we are. That's not our fight. But I am concerned that so many Christians do not understand that. We got to talk about that, especially in election season. Let's finish up the chapter. Verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court, and that seems to be why he's not part of the whole debacle of chapter 3, which we'll get to shortly. And so I just want us to think about the close of this chapter. This is an action-packed chapter, and it ends in a very shocking kind of way. The most powerful king of the ancient Near East is prostrating himself at the feet of an exiled Jew. Now, should he be worshiping Daniel? Obviously not. That was wrong. But I just want us to just be in awe of the picture of the situation that is playing out here. This is amazing. Daniel is himself is honored with these gifts and with worship. But even more than that, Daniel's God is recognized as the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the only one in the story who could reveal this mystery. But Daniel isn't just, notice how in the text, God isn't just revealing the mystery of this dream and what it means. God is revealing himself to Nebuchadnezzar, that he is a God that has international dominion over the nations of the world, not just over Israel. He is also a God who strategically positions his servants in places of chaos, in places where, oh, there's this scary dream. What does it mean? What does it mean? Daniel, God's man, is the only one in the room that's got the answer for that. And by the way, that's what he does with all of us too. He strategically positions us in the world around us where so many people are desperately searching for the answers to life and the meaning of their life, and they don't have an answer for that, and it's the people of God who do. It's the people of God who have the revelation handed to us, the ministry of reconciliation that we were talking about this morning in Bible class. This is that God, a God who uses his servants in such a way that all are forced to see the glory of his name. Going back to the Sermon on the Mount again, remember Matthew 5, let your light shine before others so that what? They can see your good works, but then do what? Glorify your Father who is in heaven. The God of heaven is the one we should serve. And so the challenge that I think runs throughout this whole chapter is this question: are we yielding our lives to the God of heaven? Nebuchadnezzar doesn't. I mean, he at the end of the chapter, he's impressed. He is in awe. I mean, Daniel can clearly do something in God's name that nobody else could in his court, and he is flabbergasted by that. But in his mind, he is just happy to add Yahweh to his pantheon of idols that he's got, that he has access to. He is not God's servant at the end of this chapter, but Daniel and his friends, in this time of crisis, they bow the knee to the God of heaven, and he grants them the blessings that they seek. Daniel is wise because he is intimately connected to his Creator. Do you remember what Paul says about Jesus in Colossians 2? That all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden away in Jesus, in Jesus' cross. As one writer put it that I was reading last week, wisdom is not a concept to be learned. It is a relationship to be enjoyed. It's not a concept to be learned. It is a relationship to be enjoyed. Do you enjoy a relationship with the God of heaven, who's also the God of Daniel, the God of Joseph, the God of Abraham, the God of all of these exiles? Are you an exile too in Jesus' kingdom, waiting for the day when Jesus will come and take you home? The people of God are waiting for that now, and if you are not part of that number, we invite you to wait for that with us and to work in Jesus' kingdom until that time comes. And so if we can help you in any way with your spiritual life, we invite you to come now as we stand up and we sing the invitation song that's been selected.